This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Tony Bruschi, thanks for joining us. Lori Vallow Daybell back in court again today. Let's go to the courtroom and take a listen.
Jury assembly room that will fill out the same questionnaire that we went through this morning. I estimate somewhere between 40 and 60 people doing that. We'll go over those answers beginning at about 10:30 a.m. We'll plan on starting at 10:30 a.m. Whoever's left, as well as the people that we approved to come back from this morning's group, will come here at 1:30 p.m. We'll begin in-person questioning. During the in-person questioning, I'm going to need the full use of the courtroom, including the seats in the back. So those of you that are in the back as spectators might not be able to be in the courtroom tomorrow during the jury selection process. I'm just letting you know. Let's talk about some of these. First of all, for the record, I did get the defendant's notice of objection to the jury questionnaire that was filed on March 20th. The defendant was objecting to, I guess, the phrasing of the allegations that the state has made, and then requested that the fact that she denies the allegation be bolded and underlined it in the questionnaire. I did get your objection. I guess de facto, I overruled the objection and the questionnaire went out as proposed. Next, I have defendant's motion in limine to preclude expert testimony of Daniel Coons dated March 10th. Let me ask the state. That's Detective Daniel Coons of the Chandler Police Department. Is he going to be testifying as an expert?
Your Honor, we did notice him as an expert in terms of his background and training and testifying as to trajectory. So we did that in abundance of caution, but we did supplement and provide the defense with the background of that. It was provided to the defense more than 30 days before trial. And defense has interviewed him since then.
What was the last part?
The defense has interviewed him since then.
Okay. So, Ms. Daybell, what's the objection?
So for 5 years, of course, he's been on the witness list to be a regular detective, and now he's being put on as an expert. I feel like to give his opinion instead of just stating the facts. So that was my main concern. I don't understand how the trajectory has anything to do with conspiracy. So I object in that way as well.
All right. Has he testified in that regard in the past?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. He has been trained in that area and taught in that area. And his relevance, Your Honor, would be because the defense has claimed a self-defense claim as well. It's relevant for that.
Can the state provide me what his opinion is, and does he have a CV?
He does not have a CV. We did actually put the opinion in the supplemental 15.1 that I filed, along with his, I believe, background and training in that as well. So,
I guess let me flesh this out a little bit more. Let me ask the defendant, you've said a couple different things. Are you saying he's not qualified as an expert, or just that the disclosure came in late and you don't think his opinion is relevant?
Well, one, I don't think his opinion is relevant, but also the fact that he's named as a firearms expert. So I don't know if he took a weekend class and that made him a firearms expert. I don't know what his experience was with that. In his CV, it just says firearms expert. So
did you ask him those questions? Was it you that interviewed him or your investigator?
My investigator interviewed him.
Do you know if he asked questions regarding his background,
sure,
training, or expertise?
Okay. So I haven't listened to that yet, so I'm not quite sure. My concern was that he was a regular detective on the witness list for 5 years, and then 30 days before trial, he's now an expert so that he can give his opinion. And I just thought that was my objection.
Well, if that was your basis of the objection on the timeliness of it, the state did comply with the rules as far as notice prior to trial and giving some sort of summary of what his opinion testimony would be. I'll take a look at it. It doesn't sound like we need any sort of Daubert hearing, but I'll take a look at it. So let's table that for now. I have defendant's motion to disclose 404B evidence dated March 14 and the state's response dated March 23. I don't know that the evidence that the state is offering to introduce necessarily 404B bad act per se, but let me hear from the defendant. You got her response?
I did.
All right. So what specific bad acts do you think should be precluded? Or were you just asking for disclosure of what they were actually intending on introducing?
I was asking for a disclosure of 404B that they planned on introducing at trial, and what I got was another theory of the case. So I didn't think that any of it was 404B relevant.
Well, I think I agree with you in so much as what was listed in their response, I wouldn't necessarily characterize as 404B evidence. But you have received that, and now you're aware of what they plan on introducing.
Somewhat.
Okay.
Correct.
I don't think I need to make a ruling on that. If there's evidentiary objections, hearsay, foundation, those types of things will be taken up when the state elicits or attempts to elicit that information. I have next defendant's motion to exclude state witnesses dated March 14 of 2025 and the state's response, specifically defendants requesting to exclude Nancy Jo Hancock, Christina Atwood, and Kay Woodcock. The state filed a response on why let me just make sure I'm looking at the right one. The state's going to offer some sort of testimony from these three witnesses that are going to talk about, it'd go toward the element of premeditation and or motive. So what is your objection specifically?
Mine, Your Honor?
Yes.
Oh, my objection was that after their interviews, after their defense interviews, that it came to light that their information came, well, one specifically came from Dateline, and then they called each other, and their information came from each other. So
I guess I'm working a little bit in the dark. What information is that?
Whatever they're, I don't know, planning on testifying about. None of them have personal knowledge of any kind of crime, so.
The state's not saying they have personal knowledge of a crime. They have personal knowledge of things that may lead a jury to infer some sort of premeditation or motive. So what information is that? Let me ask the state. or what's your offer of proof on why they're relevant?
With regards to Christina Atwood, she is a person who was present when the defendant was speaking about the victim being possessed, which goes to, again, the motive of this as well as the premeditation, and that those statements were made months in advance of the actual murder. With regards to Nancy...
So that's going to be offered as some form of admission from the defendant.
So that would be admission by party opponent, and that's personal knowledge.
Did you say that was Nancy Jo Hancock?
No, that was Christina Atwood.
Christina Atwood.
Nancy Jo Hancock is the last person that saw the victim alive prior to that. What she knew about this was hearsay, but her statements to the victim of what he should do were her understanding and expression to the victim that he should tell the defendant that he had changed the life insurance policy to stop all of this from going on. So she both sees him the night before, is aware that he's there, and then she makes statements to him regarding what he should do.
Okay. And then...
Kay Woodcock is the person who actually obtained the life insurance policy, which the state is alleging is part of the motive. And she also has information relating to the victim himself. There are allegations, again, of the self-defense, the use of a baseball bat, so she can provide background on the victim in that area as well.
All right. Do you want to have further argument?
Just the fact that this information that is supposed to be coming forward is not... All these witnesses are getting together and talking about all this and comparing all their notes and all these things beforehand, and then they're telling us that in these interviews. Well, I talked to her 100 times. Well, I talked to her every day. Well, she told me this. Well, she told me that. So their information is not firsthand. These witnesses are all coming together. They're all watching everything that goes on TV regarding this, and I would like them all precluded.
Okay, well, you're always allowed to cross-examine a witness about any biases they may have about those things that you've just talked about, colluding with other witnesses. Those are all areas of ripe for cross-examination, but they're not bases to preclude a witness. The court finds that, based on the state's avowal, that those three specific witnesses do have some minimal, although very limited, relevant information to provide and could be helpful to the jury in understanding the case. So the court will deny the motion to exclude the state's witnesses. Again, this ruling doesn't preclude you from any objections you may have to if they're testifying to hearsay or something like that. Next I have, is there a Mr. Eaton here? Appearing?
Your Honor, Matthew Kelly, I represent Mr. Eaton.
Okay. You filed a motion over the weekend. Mr. Eaton or someone that he works with filed a motion. Mr. Eaton was, let's address that now while we have people here. Mr. Eaton was listed as a witness by the defendant. Mr. Eaton apparently is a reporter in Idaho, and based on the filings, believes he doesn't have any relevant information and shouldn't be listed as a witness. So let me ask the defendant, What relevant information would Mr. Eaton have? Why is he listed as a witness?
Well, I just got this last night, so I haven't had time to read all the things that he's claiming he doesn't. But there's several things off the top of my head that that is relevant. Right now, one of the things is it's different now, right? Because he's had this off the record conversation with the prosecutor, and he's kind of made himself a witness. He's kind of made her a witness.
How so?
In the sense that if this is not prosecutorial misconduct, then one of them is going to have to testify and talk about how it's not.
Let's back up. How is he a witness to this trial? How does he have relevant information? Relevant information means a witness has testimony that makes some fact in the case more or less likely. So how does he have relevant information for what this case is about?
Okay, so initially when I put him on my witness list, my intent is because I do not know what the state is going to put on in their case in chief. And so I was calling him as a witness for the purpose of impeachment, laying foundation for interviews, rebuttal to whatever that the state might put forth, because he has interviewed almost every single witness on their witness list. And if they were to say something contrary to what they said to him on a public thing, then I would use him to lay a foundation for interviews and for impeachment. So I wasn't, that was my initial, in calling him. I found it funny when I read the beginning of this. He says that it seems to be clear attempt by Mrs. Daybell to use the rules of criminal procedure as a pretext simply to keep me out of the courtroom and interfere with my ability to report. So I had to laugh at that because it hadn't even occurred to me that he wouldn't be able to be in the courtroom if he was a witness according to 615. So that wasn't my intention. It was never my intention to do that. It was just to have him on hand if we needed to do that.
All right. Mr. Kelly, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Kelly, in theory, it sounds like if a witness said something different than they reported to Mr. Eaton at some point, I guess in theory she's right that Mr. Kelly could be called as a witness to impeach someone. But that's only allowed after the person's confronted with the actual statement that was made, and if they then deny that statement that was made. Do you have copies of his interviews and transcripts of interviews that you might want to impeach someone with?
I've been watching most of the interviews, and I take my own notes, so yes.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, two things. One, excluding Mr. Eaton under Rule 615 would be a violation of his rights under the First Amendment to attend and report on this very public trial. But more importantly, Your Honor, if Mr. Eaton were to be called as a witness, the party calling him would have to comply with ARS 12-2214, which has very stringent requirements for subpoenaing and compelling the testimony of a journalist about information that journalist has obtained in the course of news gathering. As we state in our motion, we don't believe that there is any way that Ms. Daybell can meet those requirements, but if I would suggest that if she wants to call him as a witness, she would absolutely have to follow the requirements of the subpoena law, and we would then have an opportunity to challenge that. But we don't believe that there should be any reason for Mr. Eaton to be excluded from the courtroom.
All right. I'm just thinking through this problem. If a witness got on the witness stand and said something different in testimony than you saw on an interview with Mr. Eaton, you would then play that interview. You wouldn't even need Mr. Eaton to do the impeachment because you could impeach them with the interview by playing it for them in court or something like that. So now that I'm kind of thinking it through a little more, I'm not sure.
And I wouldn't need him to lay that foundation for the interview?
I'm really trying not to give you any legal advice because you are acting as your own attorney, but if the witness admits that's them on the interview and that's their statement, that is foundation. So
he's interviewed law enforcement, almost all the law enforcement that's going to be, you know, up here on the stand. So it's not just witnesses, it's law enforcement.
Well, when I say witness, I mean generally any witness, regardless of their occupation. So I see it in only the narrowest of situations where he could even be called to as an extrinsic person to testify about the impeachment. You'd have to jump through a number of hoops before that as far as presenting the witness what the statement is, and depending on whether they admit or deny that it's them on that video or interview or whatever the case may be that you're referring to. But I'm inclined to strike him as a witness at this time, allow him to be present if he so chooses in the trial. But then again, if you wanted him as a witness, you would need to subpoena him. But at this point, I'm going to strike him from the witness list and permit him to be in the courtroom. If there's a situation where you think something has happened during the trial where you think he should be called as a witness, I guess we'll cross that bridge when and if it comes. Okay.
We could just call him up from the back?
Well, we'll address it when and if it comes, yeah.
And, Your Honor, I would ask that if that were to occur, that I would be notified and given a chance to appear and be heard.
Well, everyone will get a chance to be heard if we cross that bridge. I just don't see us crossing that bridge, but I could be wrong. So at this time, it's sort of striking Nate Eaton from the witness list. He can be present if he so chooses in the courtroom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Let's go next to the state's motion to preclude media from displaying or disclosing phone numbers and email for witnesses and victims. I guess I have no problem granting this in concept, but let me ask the state, are these people going to testify, this is my phone number or this is my email, or it's going to be displayed up as part of the evidence on the screen, or both?
Your Honor, it would be both. Some people would have to testify as to their phone numbers or emails that would also then to establish the foundation of then conversations that are on text messages, emails, iCloud accounts. So my concern obviously is there are both victims whose information could be displayed up there, and I think the Constitution allows them to request that not be displayed. But additionally, just for safety concerns, given the high-profile nature of this, for witnesses who have, several of them have attempted to not be part of the media and have not given interviews and would not want their information to be out there, given that this is being live-streamed, having their phone numbers or email addresses live-streamed out there to the world, I would ask that not be done.
All right. Does the defense want to be heard on any of that?
No, we agree.
So we're not actually being live streamed, but there's a 30-minute delay order on broadcasting what's in the courtroom. I already have a protective order that jurors can't be broadcast in any way. And I have an order that the feed can't broadcast sidebars that we might have. So I'm going to order that the feed also, to the extent you can see it visually on an exhibit or something, they shouldn't film someone's phone number or email. And then I don't know if the right person's here. Do we have the ability to, does the media have the ability to bleep out or silence if someone says my phone number is 480 blah, blah, blah. We'll find that out before we start the trial. But
thank you.
That'll be the order. As for anyone that's doing print or podcasts or anything like that, you're prohibited from reciting an entire phone number or an entire email. You can use the area code or you can use a couple digits at whatever, at live.com, at outlook.com, but I don't want their emails broadcast or reprinted. Let's go to state's motion to preclude Lonnie Dworkin and preclude noticed witnesses. Did Mr. Dworkin ever get a report prepared?
Not that the state has received.
Do you know?
So, okay. Your Honor, most likely, we're having an affidavit sent over from Mr. Dworkin tonight. He has found a discrepancy in the information that he downloaded and the information that was turned over initially by the state, and he wants to explain what that is and how that will be relevant. So if we get it tonight, we'll forward it immediately to the state, of course, tonight. He was working on a bunch of cases, and he's doing the best he could to include our case and get it done as quickly as possible as when he was assigned from OPDS.
Well, at this time, I'm inclined to preclude Mr. Dworkin, granted something pretty extraordinary happening. I offered you a continuance last time we were in court in order for you to explore that possibility. You declined the continuance. So it's any disclosures late at this point. I'm not going to slam the door on it completely because he may or may not have anything that actually ends up being useful. But at this, if depending on what he actually has, we can talk about it. But at this time, he's likely to be precluded as a witness because the state wouldn't even have an opportunity to have their own witness or rebuttal witness look at something prior to trial. But again, depending on what you have, we can talk about it again.
Okay.
The rest of your witnesses, we've already talked about Nate Eaton. I don't know if we need to go through each and every witness, but I think where I need to start is if a witness hasn't been served with a subpoena to appear in court, there's no requirement for them to show up for your trial. If they have been served, they would need to submit to an interview with the state in advance of their testimony, and then the third aspect is they need to have something relevant to testify about, which relevant, I told you a little bit ago, means they have testimony that's not based on hearsay that is tends to make either a fact more likely or not. So why don't we go through, I'm trying to compare your witness list to the state's motion. Let me see here. So Nate Eaton, as of now, is not a witness. Next, we have, I don't know how to pronounce her name. Is it Vaisia?
Vaisia.
Vaisia.
Ita Iha.
Is this one of the ones the state was able to get a hold of?
No, Your Honor. We did call the numbers and left voicemail. I've not heard, had any response, and it's my understanding that when I interviewed the defendant's investigator, Jeff White, he also was unable to speak with her.
All right. What about Gabriel Bonilla?
Your Honor, I had an update on that one in the sense that on Saturday, so when the state interviewed, again, Jeff White, the defendant's investigator, he had not been able to speak with Mr. Bonilla. I also called and left a message on the phone number that I received from the investigator. On Saturday, the attorney for Mr. Bonilla called me, and Matthew Ballard, who represents the Church of Latter-day Saints, he advised me that Mr. Bonilla has not been served with a subpoena, but I did not speak with Mr. Bonilla or was not given an option to speak with him.
So we don't know if that person's been served or if they have relevant information?
According to the attorney, Matthew Ballard, he has not been served.
All right. What about, well, why don't I just ask the state? I've got your supplemental and your other one. I know you've actually talked to a few of these people on the phone.
Correct.
Is there anyone on this list, and I'm looking at the defendant's supplemental 15.2 filed March 12 on page 2, there's a number of witnesses listed out. Is there any on this list that you have talked to that you don't object to being called?
Your Honor, I think that there is potentially minimal relevance from Summer Shiflett.
Shizlet?
I think that's a misspelling of her sister's name.
Okay.
I think there is potentially minimal relevance for Janice Cox, her mother.
Okay.
Adam Cox is actually on the state's witness list, so we don't object to him. I did speak with Zachary Cox. I'm not aware of any relevance as to this case from him, but I did speak with him.
I see in your pleading that he advised you he's not been subpoenaed.
Correct. Everyone I've spoken with has not been subpoenaed.
All right.
Your Honor, our subpoenas are with OPDS right now, and they should be being issued currently. You know, the state talks about in their response, like, the state is claiming trial by ambush from the defense. Trial by ambush. How is the defense trial by ambush when they have interviewed every single one of these witnesses before in the last 5 years since this case started? They've interviewed every single person that has been on there. They have written transcripted interviews and video interviews of all of these people. And so how they are relevant, these witnesses will testify if and when they are needed to add additional facts or fill in the blanks that the state will no doubt leave out in their case in chief, and they'll be called accordingly. I need them to lay perhaps foundations for evidence presented by the state. The same with Lonnie Dworkin. I need him. His testimony will be required if and when it's necessary to rebut digital information that the state will bring forward during trial. I feel like the state is trying to say, okay, if you want your speedy trial, guess what? We're not going to let you defend yourself. Guess what? You can't have any experts. And guess what else? You can't have any witnesses. You can't have anybody speak in your behalf. So good luck. Have a nice day.
All right. Well, that's why attorneys sometimes take a long time to prepare for a trial, because they need to give notice of what all the testimony their witnesses are going to give. They need their experts to prepare reports. That's why your prior attorneys and your current attorneys were asking for more time to prepare the case. So you can't really have it both ways, that you want your speedy trial rights, but you don't want to give notice to the other side of what your evidence is.
I don't not want to give notice to the other side. With the limitations at the incarcerated state where I am, and the limitations with OPDS of getting Lonnie Dworkin late in the game that they did, I've done everything in my power as a defendant to prepare the state and to give over everything that I could do within my power with the limitations that I am an incarcerated person at this maximum security prison jail.
So when you say,
and I shouldn't be able to represent myself because of that fact, that negates my constitutional right?
I didn't say that. All right. I said that sometimes there are reasons to not go forward to trial as fast as you want. All right. So when you say things like they're going to fill in the blanks, that makes it really hard to assess what their relevant information is.
They have relevant information to a lot of factors that I got in the 404B information. For example, the life insurance. My father is a life insurance salesman. He worked with Charles on getting both life insurance policies, my $2 million policy and Charles' $1 million policy. He also tried to sell my insurance policy after Charles passed away. He also told me to go to call the insurance policy and said, how to do that, how to call them when you're the beneficiary. I didn't know how to do any of those things. He has relevant information to that. My sister has relevant information to my brother, Alex Cox, and the whole situation of what happened on July 11th. These people have relevant information to the state's case, what they're accusing me of. There's very relevant information from a lot of these witnesses.
So what I'm struggling with is, you just saying that it's relevant doesn't actually make it relevant. It may be relevant. I'm trying to find out the relevancy. What you said about your father being an insurance salesman and selling policies, that sounds relevant. It could be relevant to me. Who's your father? I don't know who your father is.
Barry Cox.
All right. Barry Cox. It sounds like, even from what you're saying, though, you're not, depending on what the state produces at trial, you're not sure that these witnesses would have relevant information. It just depends, is what it sounds like.
Whatever they put up in their case in chief, am I not allowed to try to defend myself against that?
That's the latest Lori Vallow-Daybell in the courtroom. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our continuing coverage on this case and the others we're following for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.